You're listening to Energy Insiders, a weekly update on clean energy and climate policy with Renew Economies editor Giles Parkinson and leading energy analyst David Leach. Energy Insiders is brought to you by Evergen, providing cutting-edge energy management software for battery optimization, virtual power plants and distributed energy resources. And Pylon, helping solar installers and retailers design high-resolution solar proposals in minutes.
Hello and welcome to this latest episode of the Energy Insiders podcast. My name is Giles Parkinson. I'm the editor of Renew Economy and its associated websites, the EV-focused The Driven and One Step Off the Grid. And joining me as usual is ITK Principal David Leach. David, I trust you are well.
I am well, thanks, Giles. I trust our listeners are well. I'd like to announce that this podcast is made in Australia and therefore we'll be applying for the first available made in Australia tax break, most likely.
Well, we're bound to get it, I think. I think we consider that a shoo-in. Yes, Anthony Albanese's Made in Australia plan will be one of the things that we'll be talking about, along with various news around the place, Fortescue's green hydrogen electrolyzer plant, and quite a lot of battery and storage news and a few other things going on. But first, David, we've invited for the second time Laurie Miliberta. Yes.
Senior fellow at the Asia Society and one of, in my opinion, the best people going to talk on what's happening in China.
Let's have a listen to Laurie Miliberta from the Asia Society.
Laurie Miliberta, senior fellow at the Asia Society, thanks very much for joining the Energy Insiders podcast.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
And we're talking to you all the way from Helsinki. And I guess this is the first time we've had a guest on the podcast from Helsinki. But nevertheless, you're a senior fellow at the Asia Society, which I guess comes from you being in China for a while. But can you tell me just a little bit about the Asia Society, what it is, how big it is, maybe in terms of people and what its objectives are?
For sure. So the Asia Society is a very old a DC-based think tank that is focused on fostering relationships and between Asian countries and societies and the US in particular. Used to be headed by Kevin Rudd, so there's a bit of an Australia connection as well there. What I do is the Asia Society Policy Institute has started a new hub focused on China's climate policy and the US-China climate relationship or interactions. And so I'm focused on in my role there on looking at China's upcoming climate commitments. China, like every other country, has to submit new 2035 climate commitments next year in 2025 and in general tracking China's emissions trends, energy trends, trying to understand where the country is going and what the opportunities are for diplomacy.
And I think you lived in China or at least have a good familiarity with China stemming from your former role at Greenpeace as the China lead for some years. Am I right?
So I lived in Beijing from 2015 to 2019. Going there, working with first with the Greenpeace team, and then with my own team at the Center for Research on Energy and Clean Air, closely tracking these things. At Greenpeace, my role was global. I was focused on air pollution. Built a unit called Global Air Pollution Unit. But that was also, of course, very much involved in the work in China, starting from 2012 when air pollution became a huge public issue in the country.
Yes, and we should talk about the CREF, but we really need to go into China itself, which is I have a long-standing interest in following China, which after all is the world's second largest economy, I guess, and certainly a very energy-intensive one. I guess for some years, China looked as if it was slowing down frankly, its growth in coal consumption. And it looked like it was quite, and it looked more serious about its climate targets than it seems it has recently. But over the last year or two, for various reasons, it seems to me that China's been growing its coal-fired electricity capacity as fast as it's been growing its renewables, or just about as fast, and that the total amount of coal it mines each year has gone from something like 3.5 billion tonnes to 4.5 billion tonnes. Perhaps you could talk a little bit about what caused that growth and where you see things going for the next 2 or 3 years and why.
For sure. So China's CO2 emissions have obviously grown dramatically for the past more than two decades, especially since the early noughties, and have been the key driver of global emission growth. There was a very forceful surge in emissions after the global financial crisis, when the government started an unprecedented construction stimulus, the consumption of cement and steel for all of that construction skyrocketed. Then around 2013, 2014, that stimulus started to wear off, and there was a central government policy aiming to move to a new normal in the economy, where economic growth would be driven much more by private consumption, by services, by high-tech industries, rather than these smokestack industries. A lot of other things happened. The war on corruption that Xi Jinping started led to a slowdown in construction projects because so many of them were tangled in shady deals. And there was the war on air pollution, which was the first time that China started seriously thinking about reducing coal consumption. There was another turnaround, initially in response to the Trump tariffs. So the government again responded to a negative economic shock by stimulating construction. And then during the zero COVID period, there were policies that heavily promoted industry and exports, and led to another surge in emissions. So emissions growth, in fact, accelerated during zero COVID, even though the economy slowed down. At the same time, China obviously announced the carbon neutrality goal in 2020, and launched a massive expansion in clean energy, both manufacturing and deployment, again completely unprecedented. Even that hasn't been enough to cover the recent surge in energy consumption. I think that we're going to see a turnaround this year, because energy consumption is going to slow down, and all of the clean energy that has been installed last year, 2023, is going to start showing up in power generation.
And yet at the same time, I think there's still something like 70 gigawatts of new coal generation actually being built. I think one of the things that's surprising is the actual growth in power consumption. But just before we get to the outlook, and if we talk a little bit more about the drivers of what's been going on, I think one thing was that there was a change in policy at one stage that moved the centralized sort of permitting of everything and devolved some responsibility out into the provinces. And at the time, the narrative was that the provinces did coal generation because it could be financed and provided employment. And then as we look forward, despite the slowdown in construction that is very evident at the moment, in fact, we're still seeing growth in steel works being built, which are, of course, very carbon intensive themselves. And as I said, we've seen this expansion in coal mining. But I guess wasn't there also a sort of imperative that energy security was totally important for China, in terms of the Ukraine war, and they had to become even more self-reliant than they were. But I don't really think they have, because they're still importing as much coal as ever, and oil, just about.
Absolutely. So the energy security framing drives me a bit mad, because it's a code word for so many different things. The government has been driving, as you noted, a massive expansion in domestic coal mining in order to stave off exports, imports of coal. That hasn't really been successful. So coal imports have increased very dramatically over the past couple of years, even as all of this domestic mining expansion was happening. So what happened there was that the government tried to get output to increase and to drive prices down for domestic coal, but that didn't really work out. The quality of the coal that was mined dropped. The miners who were forced to sell at lower prices started skimping on coal washing, so they were shipping much lower quality coal. The tonnages went up, but the energy content of the coal didn't, and many power plants were unable or unwilling to use the coal that they would have been getting from domestic sources, so they turned to imports. And this has turned the energy security argument on its head. When Li Keqiang started raising energy security again at a higher level in 2019, everyone heard that as a code word for coal. But now the government has had to also constrain uses of coal other than power in the name of energy security, and it has made it clear that reliance on coal doesn't equal energy security anymore.
We won't have the time, unfortunately, to go into the coal industry, but I've just observed that, like any other form of mining, there's a kind of replacement rate. We know that in the gas or oil industry, that if you don't build new stuff, you get about 6 or 7% less out of your wells every year, just as a result of them getting old. And when you think about 4.5 billion tons of coal production each year, that's about 10 times Australia's coal production. The actual decline rate, the need to open new mines every year just to stand still, must be very high.
That's right, and even more because the government has also had a drive of closing down older, less mechanized, less safe mines. I just wanted to flag the other energy security, because I said that it's a code word for many things. So the other things that people talk about mean when they say energy security is capacity adequacy, making sure that you have enough dispatchable capacity to meet peak load at any moment. And so what's happening in China is that if you look at the numbers, there's much more capacity, coal, hydro, nuclear, increasingly pumped storage hydro, than should be needed to meet peak loads and keep the lights on. But yet there are periodic shortages of electricity, and there is massive concern about the adequacy of capacity. And what gives is that the management of the grid is so inflexible and outdated, the way that the grid is managed, that it creates a need for redundant capacity. And this is also very important for renewables going forward, reforming the grid.
Yes, it is. And that's been a topic in China, I think, for 15 years at least, without, I don't know how much progress has been made. I'm sure the China Grid Company is by far the biggest electricity company in the world, business in the world. But Just before we move on to the outlook, another thing that was going on in theory was some deregulation of electricity prices and customers being able to shop around. I don't know if are you and what's been happening with electricity prices throughout as the consumption growth and the supply growth have both increased.
Probably the most important thing that happened is back in 2021 when coal prices rose because of Russia's cutting off supply to Europe, gas supply, the coal-fired power plants found that because their selling prices, the electricity prices that they were paid, were fixed by the government, but coal prices were determined on the market, they found that they're out of the money in a big way. They were generating at a loss, couldn't even cover their fuel costs. And so the government introduced a float where the price paid to coal-fired power generators can move within a specified range from the previous fixed benchmark tariff. There has been a lot of incremental changes, introduction, especially of long-term contracts that tries to introduce some market-based price discovery electricity trade. Now there's gradual progress in introducing spot markets for electricity. So a lot of things are happening more slowly than you would hope. The target is to have a unified national power market by 2030, which compared with the things that the speed at which things happen in China is not very impressive, and especially because the lack of a functioning market is driving construction of new coal-fired power plants right now. The last major development is the introduction of capacity payments to coal-fired power plants and to pumped hydro plants, which unfortunately is not a market-based thing or a technology-neutral thing. So it's something that the government fixes for each source and doesn't really oblige the operators to actually provide that capacity. So it's more of a subsidy than a real capacity yes. payment.
And of course, the consumers also often benefit from being state-owned enterprises. The steelworks, there's a lot of... I think if I looked at the numbers, the power prices are still sort of, I don't know, what would we be talking, US $50 or something like that? Would you have a number off the top of your head?
Everything varies by province and by consumer segment. The prices is fairly low for residential, but in fact the listed tariffs for industry are not that low. They're very comparable to many European countries and so on. China does cross subsidy the other way. Most high income countries have lower prices for industry and higher for residential. China is the other way around. But what happens a lot is discounted deals for energy intensive factories. So that's very non-transparent. But it was even a policy during zero COVID firms were getting discounts on their power. And that's one key reason why China's emissions surged. Producers, for example, in the chemical and non-ferrous metal industry were able to claw market share from the global market, even though global demand was tepid and demand in China was weak as well.
So that's and so, you know, China is very energy intensive, as well as being very big in energy. And the fact that electricity consumption is growing has grown so well, even through a construction slowdown, and despite the fact that the underlying fuel is expensive, that's the coal, means that there's a lot of subsidization for going on right through the system, probably not too different to Australia. Now, as we look forward, you mentioned that China's now sort of also focusing on the new industries, on solar and on wind, on batteries and on electric vehicles. And certainly in electric vehicles, it's been incredibly successful, I think, so far. And maybe that's also driving some electricity consumption, I don't know. But before we talk about emissions, what do you think is going to happen to electricity consumption growth rates over the next few years? And I appreciate how silly forecasting is as a business. I really do appreciate it. But what are your thoughts about the actual electricity consumption and, you know, the energy intensity of China? It can't really stay as high as it can. It can't stay as a construction-centric economy forever, can it?
China's shifted very dramatically in the past few years from a construction-centric to a manufacturing-centric economy. So steel consumption for real estate halved in the past few years, a huge shift. And all of that was taken up by manufacturing. A lot of that was, in fact, manufacturing of industrial machinery. So it's not just using that to make cars, but to using that to produce factories that make cars and clean energy equipment and a lot of other stuff. And that kind of growth especially cannot go on forever, because if you want to grow investment in manufacturing, you have to not only produce more every year, but you have to accelerate the growth rate of your industrial production every year. And that's not possible, because China's already saturated the global market for so many of the products and commodities that it produces. On the clean energy side, it's a really dramatic story, because basically China's built the capacity to supply all the solar panels, all the batteries, all the electric vehicles that you would want to have globally in a 1.5 degree scenario. We're talking about solar power manufacturing capacity in operation and under construction equal to 1 terawatt hour. 1 terawatt per year, so 1,000 gigawatts per year, whereas global installations were less than
300 gigawatts.
Just a couple of years ago, last year China alone installed more than 200. Now we're in a phase where the local supply from China is upending global projections for solar.
Yes, and I think also even the wind turbine market in China was something like 65 or 70 gigawatts last year, and certainly about they produce enough electric cars. I think about 25% of total car production in China, which is about equal to 50% of US car production, is fully electric. So those are very big numbers, but still we see this growth in electricity consumption. Still we see these new coal plants being built. It's a little hard to have enough faith, isn't it, really? I think you wrote yourself that China is unlikely to meet its emission goals and its targets that it's set, or if it does do them, it will require something very dramatic to happen in the next few years.
So I think China's emissions are most likely to fall this year and then begin to stabilize from there on, at least. But even that isn't enough to meet the targets for 2025, because the surge in emissions since 2020 was so dramatic. Back in 2021, when the targets for 2025 were set, they looked like they would enable just business as usual growth in emissions to continue. But we had this surge over the past 3 years. That means that now emissions have to fall in absolute terms from 2023 to 2025 to meet those targets. So even in my maybe optimistic scenario where we see a fall this year and then more or less a stabilization, even then the targets for 2025 won't necessarily be met. The other thing is China's electrifying very rapidly thanks to those electric vehicles, but especially in industry. And that means that electricity consumption is going to grow and can grow quite rapidly, even if total energy consumption growth slows down. And that's, of course, for emissions, that's the most important factor. Already from 2025 to 2020, fossil fuel consumption in China outside of the power sector fell. And so that means that all the emission growth was coming from the power sector. And so that's what likely what we're going to see over this decade as well, that power sector emissions stabilize or even inch up slightly, but because of the reduction in non-power sector emissions, we see total emissions come down.
Yes, Laurie, I noted a report just recently from RMI, the Rocky Mountain Institute, which sort of identifies China as the first sort of true electro state in the world, and just sort of pointing out to the sort of that level of electrification which they've reached, and suggesting that within a couple of years they might actually reach sort of, you know, 50% of all energy consumption might be electric, which you know, we keep on thinking that the grid is everything in terms of energy consumption, but it actually is, it's historically been a very minor part. That's an extraordinary achievement, isn't it? And would have implications not just for China but also for the rest of the world, considering their dominance of the wind and solar and even the EV industries.
The electrification in China has definitely been impressive. So I mentioned EVs and industry. Households are at least as big a part of the story. I do have to say, sitting in Finland, one of the Nordic countries, that we do have much higher electrification rates than China does at the moment. So at least some Nordic countries are electrifying as well through electric vehicles, heat pumps, industry as well, starting to create the first green steel production with hydrogen and so on. So it's happening in other parts of the world as well. But of course, given China's scale, China's gone up 10 percentage points in terms of the share of electricity in total energy consumption, and is now above a quarter. So of course, given China's scale, that's unprecedented. Anything that happens in China is unprecedented, really, given the scale.
And David has published an article just sort of focusing on some of the cost reductions in wind and solar technologies in particular, and of course, you know, sort of, you know, as we've sort of mentioned several times, sort of, you know, China is a driving factor in the low cost production of EVs, and it was, look, it's a fascinating article. It's probably sort of the benefits of which we get to see sort of, you know, thoroughly in Australia. But sort of what's just the scale, is just simply the scale of what's been sort of, you know, being produced in China, and what sort of scope do you see for even further cost reductions over the sort of, say, the coming 5-year period?
So costs went down 50%, or prices went down 50% last year for both solar and batteries. And, you know, these are industries where the typical year sees double digits. Digit reductions in costs, so it's still impressive, even in
it's extraordinary.
Yeah, absolutely, and of course some of that was reduced margins, but it's also constant innovation and increased subsidies. It's all of those things combined. There's a lot more capacity still coming online, so I do think costs will continue to fall further. Certainly, some manufacturers are saying that they're going to introduce even lower cost production capacity this year. But I think even the current prices are just when you start to think about what's possible with solar and batteries at the current prices, then I think that's already revolutionary. We don't really have to worry about getting a lot lower, because in so many applications, solar plus batteries is going to be competitive against gas-fired power plants, for example. So that really has the potential to upend the entire energy plans for many countries, and for China itself as well. So it's much more about internalizing how fast the economics have already changed, and getting that reflected in investment decisions and energy policy decisions.
Yeah, and just sort of one final one from me before handing back to David. That sort of 50% reduction in solar and battery prices over the last 12 months, I mean, it does sound extraordinary. So just sort of clarify then, that is sustainable. That's not just like a one-off sort of due to sort of overcapacity and people just sort of price cutting just to sort of get rid of supply. These are actually the results of sort of innovations, manufacturing efficiencies that can actually keep those prices down over the long term, and actually, offer the potential to cut them further.
It's of course hard to quantify because manufacturers are keeping those things close to chest, and especially the drivers of those price reductions. Qualitatively, it's very easy to say that all of those things play a role. You're making solar panels thinner, you're making them more efficient, so you're needing less material to produce the same power. There are, of course, as I mentioned, huge subsidies as well.
It's just learning rate effects, really. It's just when you double production, your unit cost, or double the installed production, your unit cost will fall by some amount. We observe that in just about every industry, and so when they grow the production a lot, the costs fall. It's kind of like a law of nature.
Yeah, and that's a good point. So solar module production in China was up by more than 100% last year. So in that sense, those cost reductions are what you should expect, just based on Moore's law or the equivalent for solar.
That's right. You don't actually have to know the specific technical driver. You just have to know the growth rate to an extent. But let's not dwell on that. I wanted to come back to more difficult and far more intangible topics. The first thing is, it's very, very hard for an outsider. I know you work with people who at a minimum actually speak Chinese, but what is the mood? What do you think is, what's your understanding of the feeling towards China's emissions goals and the, the industrial path that they've been on for the past few years? Rational people all around the world must see that, it's a grim future for our descendants if China keeps on growing its emissions, and China must see that itself.
I think everyone who pays close attention to this and keeps an open mind just seems to fluctuate between hope and despair, because the developments are so dramatic. When people are seeing new numbers on what's happening in clean energy, it seems like this is just happening so fast that it's going to fix the whole thing. And then you see how much energy consumption and emissions went up last year, and you despair again. I think, of course, a lot of people will just decide which side they're on and hammer that. It's a very dynamic thing. In terms of climate, it's of course in the back of a lot of people's heads. In China, there's a lot of very good and strong research on the impacts of climate change in China. It's It's not something like it's not polarized in the way that it is in the Anglosphere. That it's very well recognized, but it's defining where do you set the bar? Is it enough to peak emissions by 2030 and then very gradually inch your way towards carbon neutrality by 2060, or do we need much deeper reductions? How optimistic are you about carbon removal in the future? How optimistic are you about adaptation? Of course, there's a whole range of views.
Yeah, there are. And I my experience is that it's policymakers who internalize this really deeply, who do in the end drive change one way or another. And it's kind of interesting to see whether those people, and they have names, exist at a high enough level to actually be influential in that policy. And I just don't know. But I also want to ask about transmission before we get to the end here. And I know it's probably more boring, but I mean, the way electricity prices are set, the way whether wind and solar can get on the grid, and I believe that sort of the spillage rates have increased this year for the first time in years. The rate of transmission connection to new renewable energy, you know, and the whole regulatory system is very important to making it work in the future. What do you see as the main issues that need to be resolved for China to achieve its goals as efficiently as possible?
Right. So what happened already last year is that a lot of provincial grid operators started saying that they don't have capacity to take on more solar or wind, especially distributed solar, which was growing very fast. And the constraint for them is that there has been this slightly unofficial red line of 5% curtailment. So not more than 5% of potential wind or solar generation should be denied access to the grid. Now there's talk about relaxing that, moving that to 10%, because that would enable those provincial grid operators to take on a lot more wind and solar without fixing the underlying issues. Of course, that would affect the profitability and create some uncertainty. The good thing about this dynamic is that the whole surge in the deployment of solar and wind has been very strongly driven by the provinces rather than the central government. They've run far ahead of the central government's targets, and so this dynamic creates a very strong incentive for the governments to fix these issues. The thorniest issue to tackle is transmission between provinces, which is still very bureaucratic and rigid. So there will be a lot of potential to resolve these issues by making dispatch across provinces flexible in the way that when you have a lot of solar generation in one province, it can be dispatched to other provinces. It might be mind-boggling that this is not happening, but it isn't at the moment. So every province is managing things more or less as if they were an island, and then just transmitting to other provinces on fixed schedules.
It really makes me laugh, Laurie, in a sense that I think everywhere, I went to the United States, I probably could hear in different words a similar sort of issue. Very few countries seem to get the transmission side of things done properly before they build the wind and the solar, and then they find that it's much harder to fix that up after. But anyway, I'm talking too much. We've asked a lot
I'll just say on that the constraint in China is slightly different. So for the US and a lot of Europe, the challenge is getting the infrastructure built. So you just don't have the physical wires in place to do the dispatch. In China, getting the wires in place is not a problem. It's getting them used in a flexible way. So So it's at least a thorny issue, but it's an institutional issue, not a physical infrastructure one.
That's great. Look, Laurie, Giles and I have asked you a lot of questions which require a very deep knowledge, and I think it's been a fantastic discussion. But because we don't always ask the right questions, are there any other points you wanted to get across to our audience as we get to the end of this discussion?
I, as you've probably heard, I do have the habit of saying what I want to say in response to the questions. So I think we've really covered a lot of ground and gone through most of it. I think the one thing that maybe comes through in between the different topics is that China is a very complex place. It's often thought of as a top-down place where everything's determined by the top leadership, but so many things are more complicated when you zoom in. So a lot of the transformation that has been happening has been driven by provinces, by state-owned enterprises, even private investors in the case of the growth in clean energy and so on. And that's both a challenge, but also a reason for hope because as I said, the transformation has been happening much faster than the central government was preparing to target, or at least the growth in clean energy has been happening much faster because of all these other drivers.
Yeah, and I'm going to ask you one casual forecast question. I think you know, the share of thermal electricity in total electricity production, and I don't even know if the numbers I see include behind the meter rooftop, but it's around, thermal's around 70%, the same as last year, and not much different from what it was a few years ago. If we come back in 5 years, what do you think the share of thermal energy will be as a percentage of total electricity consumption?
I think it will go down very fast. So the past few years have stagnated because of the very high demand growth and because of a slump in hydropower. So already this year, we'll see a big jump when hydropower, by all accounts, should come back, and we see all of the renewable growth in generation. I have an Excel sheet that would give a precise answer. I think it's possible to get to 45% non-fossil or non-thermal, so basically coal and gas, going down to 55% by 2030.
Great. That's a nice forecast for us to end this discussion on. Thanks very much to Laurie Miliverta, to you for joining this this podcast, and good luck with your parental leave over the next 6 months.
Thank you so much, and thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, no, I'd like to add my thanks too, Laurie. So great to have you on the podcast. That was Laurie Miliverta from the Asia Society. Now, some of listeners might have actually heard that one previously. We got very excited and we got ahead of ourselves and recorded two interviews. And unfortunately, the one with Jason Huang, or this one, the Laurie interview, was briefly featured on an episode that was supposed to feature Jason Huang from TS Conductors, which we did last week. If you did get crosswires on that one, the Jason Huang interview is back up again and very, very interesting. Got a lot of fantastic feedback about that. But just on this interview, David, look, fascinating. Look, Laurie's all, you know, it's just great insight into what's happening in China. I found that very interesting. I possibly would have liked to hear more about sort of, you know, how they're just, you know, the impact of their sheer domination of the wind, solar, and other industries. But really interesting insight into sort of the transition and some of the challenges in China.
Look, China's 50% of the world's manufacturing of a lot of stuff, and it's a bigger percentage of manufacturing of solar panels for sure. And we'll be talking more about China. I mean, whatever you position you take, you can find something in China to support it. What we do know is that it's easily the world's largest emitter of carbon. But the question of why that is, and whether it's because they manufacture stuff that otherwise would be manufactured somewhere else and would still be emitting carbon, is an important issue as well. But, you know, there's so much to talk about there. We probably won't talk about it now. Just follow the news flow. And what's been going here in Australia, as you know, Giles, we've taken a very strong interest in international developments for years. A couple of years ago, we ran a great interview talking about the Inflation Reduction Act in the United States when it was first introduced. We interviewed, Roberts, who came out here at the behest of the trade unions to talk about the USA. And it seems like Made in Australia is becoming a thing again.
Well, look, I mean, one of the things about China is that everything is now made in China. I mean, its domination of the solar and the wind and the battery industries is just sort of so complete. And what we're seeing across the world is countries, particularly in the US with the IRA, and in Europe and other Asian countries, are trying to sort of win back some of their manufacturing, and that requires a fair bit of investment. I think Australia finds itself in a position now where if it doesn't make this investment, then it's just going to keep on being a quarry and nothing else. And I think there's many people arguing that this is our real opportunity now to actually, you know, become a smart country and get some manufacturing, because we've got a lot of expertise, and the crossover between the minerals and our own opportunities in green energy seems to be a unique occasion to actually sort of do make things in Australia. Could be green iron, could be green steel, could be hydrogen, could be some solar panels, could be parts of wind components. Let's wait and see. But overall, I think it's got a pretty good reception. I mean, what's your take, David?
Well, it's the same reason why it had a popular reception in the United States. It's all carrot and no stick. And the innovation, in a sense, in modern protectionism, if you want to think about it that way, or trade barrier, is that it's a tax incentive, so it doesn't show up to consumers as a price impact. It effectively shows up as less government revenue to the extent that it actually works. And so it's hard to have an objection to it on that basis. I personally am a free trade person by and large, and comparative advantage. And you said Australia is not a smart country. I actually think we're a very smart country, relatively speaking. I think, as has been said many times, that Professor Martin Green invented a lot of the solar technology. And I argue that you might get far better value for your investment or tax dollar or investment dollar by putting more money into universities and into education and into the commercialization of technology rather than straight manufacturing and assembly, which is mostly often done by robots and stuff anyway. Many of the people are employed in other areas of the business, and administration, in sales and logistics, but we can still always do the product design and stuff. Anyway, it's a complex topic, but I would like to see more money going into the innovation side of it rather than the assembly.
No, that's fair enough. And look, my apologies to the whole of Australia if I sort of meant to say it wasn't a smart country. I guess what I was trying to say, it could be even smarter, particularly in the way it runs its economy. Because I'm not too sure how much of a future there is in just being a giant quarry, but maybe there is. I don't know.
I think also, Giles, I keep saying, but people underestimate how much technology actually is in the mining industry. All of this manufacturing is going to need a lot of raw materials. You know, the question is really just about how much you process the raw materials. And, you know, when you've got, we've already got like robot trains, robot trucks moving the ore material around, super sophisticated technology that's sort of running the whole thing, giant scale. We do have a very good advantage in some of the things that we do. Anyway.
Well, look, speaking about manufacturing, Fortescue Metals opened its electrolyzer factory in Gladstone this week, officially opened it. It's a 2-gigawatt factory. I've actually done an interview with the head of Fortescue Hydrogen for Renew Economy, so I've got some interesting insights which we'll be publishing on Friday about the size of that facility, which is actually bigger than we thought. about the nature of the technology that they're building there. PEM electrolyzers, which just happen to sort of be more flexible and sort of better suited to Australia's sort of renewable mix, which is wind and solar, and therefore variable. And some interesting insights there on who their customers might be and when they might turn up and when people might start thinking about really big projects rather than the really small projects that they're thinking about now. But David, I mean, doesn't this sort of suggest that, you know, manufacturing can be done?
Oh, yes. I've got no doubt that manufacturing can be done. Australia's got great manufacturing success stories. James Hardy Industries is the world's biggest manufacturer of fibre cement, which now goes on more than 20% of US houses, starting from nothing. CSL, which started as a small government spin-off, has become a giant in the serum labs. We're good at manufacturing certain things, but inevitably the better we get, the more we'll end up taking it to offshore markets. And it's we've also got a very viable agribusiness sector, which I think people forget about, very specialised food additives and a huge market in nearby Asia. So, yes, Australia can make things. And, you know, people criticise, now want to introduce all this sort of tax incentives and things, but you have to remember that whenever Hawke and Keating and John Button came to power, they dismantled all the existing tariffs, floated the dollar, and, you know, Australia's economy has been booming and powering ahead ever since. And employment has gone up heaps and heaps and heaps as the population's gone up. And we've done that without having the stuff that's now been talked about. But yes, we don't do that much manufacturing of day-to-day goods in Australia so much.
Storage is once again the big news of the last week. In fact, we've heard very little in the way of new wind and solar announcements. I think possibly we had the start of construction of the Aldoga solar plant in Queensland, but we've known about that. That's coming for a while. A couple of big storage announcements. I guess the big, most eye-catching one was the Zen Energy one for a 1 gigawatt, 10 hours, or is it 8 hours, I think, pumped hydro project on Lake Burragarang. So basically at the other end of the lake that sort of is dammed by the Warragamba Dam, which is Sydney's main drinking water, and the other end of it stretches about 50 kilometres, that lake, and about 40 kilometres away, it's just near, well, that's where they're thinking of putting this pumped hydro facility and using as the upper reservoir a former colliery washing pit. So no new pits needed, probably a bit of tunnelling, a few generator halls and things like that. But look, interesting. It's probably 7-8 years away, but it was interesting to hear them talk about sort of the cost of it, which is probably going to be about one quarter that of Snowy Hydro, because they have to dig tunnel 1.6
kilometres. That's where Snowy started, don't forget, about one quarter of where it is now. But go on.
That's true too. So, but look, it's interesting that we're starting to see more pumped hydro projects coming out of the woodwork now, and I guess that's in recognition that the capacity investment scheme is probably going to have to address it somehow. It's obviously not doing it yet, and we're probably going to see initiatives, at least from the Victoria and the New South Wales governments, through their sort of state-owned energy corps and the variations of it. To actually sort of try and work out how to get pumped hydro, you know, actually into construction and then production, because the only one that we've seen really, apart from Snowy Hydro, Snowy 2.0, is Genex, which sounds like it's going very well, but that's interesting.
And they're all government-owned, right? Or got strong government support, all of these projects at the moment in pumped hydro.
I don't think that's going to change.
No. And they're competing against batteries, where the price is at the moment at least coming down quite dramatically, and is expected on average to keep coming down all the time. And batteries offer all this flexibility and stuff. But anyway, that's a somewhat ongoing debate, but it's great to see these new announcements. I'd also mention that I think we're seeing, last year the story was all about how the transmission won't be there. And that was a reason why renewable developers couldn't commit to anything, as well as the fact that they can't get anything through the planning department, We've seen a few bits and pieces go through the planning department, but it does seem to have stopped again. And from what I understand, there's also issues with federal planning that have to be overcome even after you get through state planning. But on the transmission side of things, we are seeing gradual progress. I mean, for me, HumeLink is one of the most important lines that's going to be built in certainly for New South Wales, but I think it's just generally important. And we're seeing that gradually progressing with more preliminary spending, like in the hundreds of millions of dollars being done and more about to be applied for. We've seen the VNI West in Victoria go through a review by Jacobs and be approved more or less as it is. And as I've said before, we've seen the Orana transmission line. You can pretty much know the cost and price of that if you're a renewable developer, like, for instance, the Liverpool Rangers wind farm, 1,400 megawatts potentially. All of that's going to be very important for the people who are going to win the bids in the capacity investment scheme, for which something like six gigawatts of wind and solar has to be bid in within the next 2 or 3 months. So, and then we see the results 3 months later. So I guess, under the surface of nothing much happening, and there's still actually a lot going on, I think.
No, that's right. That's right. Yeah, look, I might just do a bit of a round up some of the other battery news, because batteries seem to be the thing that are moving. We saw this week Origin sign its first third-party offtake agreement with a big battery. This is the Supernode battery, which is owned by Quinbrook Infrastructure Partners up in pretty much the middle of Brisbane, actually, in Brendale, not very far away from where Acacia is building their own battery. That's the first stage of what will be a 2 gigawatt-hour battery. The first stage is a 500 megawatt-hour battery, 2 hours. Speaking of Acacia, they got their GPS in good time for the Waratah Super Battery, so that's good, and I'm sure everyone's minds was concentrated on waving that one through, because we've seen delays for things like the Capital Battery, which sort of finally sort of started dancing with the grid this week, almost a year after it was supposed to be. And a couple other things to observe. Tesla, Neoen and Iberdrola have asked for a rule change. They say there's unintended consequences from where the retailer reliability obligation is structured. Basically, sort of means that the batteries can't play the role that they're supposed to be playing and can't provide the grid services they're supposed to be without a simple rule change. So it's just another one of those sort of kind of oversights that people sort of come up with a really good rule or what seems like a good rule, and someone goes, oh, hang on, what about this? It means we can't use the batteries. So they're hoping that they can get a quick response to that. And just the other thing I just mentioned was the webinar that we held this week. We had the guys from Acacia and Eco Energy and Climate Energy Finance, and it was an hour-long webinar just discussing the different projects and some of the incentives and the market signals. It was actually really quite interesting. We had a lot of people attending that webinar, so if you did miss out on it, if you look on Renew Economy, you should be able to find it there somewhere and have a listen. David, I'm just wondering if there's anything else to mention before we go.
No, we've run a bit long today, Charles, so I think if there is something else, I'm sure we can do it next week.
We will. Okay. Thank you very much, David. Thanks to Laurie Miller-Verter for joining us in this episode. Thanks, of course, to our sponsors, Pylon and Evergen. Thanks to everyone out there listening. Thanks for your feedback. Thanks for your heads up pointing out the error that we made in last week's episode. And we'll be back again this time next week, or at least next week. Bye for now.
Energy Insiders was brought to you by Evergen, the market-leading renewable energy software business that optimises residential and commercial solar and battery systems. Evergen enables large numbers of systems to operate as a single fleet, so network operators can use them as a virtual power plant, generating significant value for consumers, network operators, and the energy system as a whole. Evergen software is powering the energy system of the future. Energy Insiders was also brought to you by Pylon. Pylon provides easy-to-use solar design software for installers and retailers with pay-as-you-go pricing, no monthly cost, and no lock-in contracts. Join Australia's top solar companies who trust Pylon to design high-resolution, CEC-ready solar proposals.